Welcome back to the Bonfire Podcast, where we talk about the UFC and mixed martial arts with those closest to the fight game. I am your host, longtime MMA journalist and MMA junkie senior reporter, Mike Bon. Hope you all doing very well out there. I really appreciate all the great support of last week's show with Luke Thomas. We hit a big threshold on the YouTube channel, and that's all a shout out to your major support out there. Appreciate everyone who drops likes, comments, subscriptions, whatever it may be on any platform you support on. Let's keep this thing rolling. I feel very good about where the show is heading, and the feedback from you guys is the main reason for that. So hopefully another great show that you all enjoy coming here today. We are bringing back the great coach Dean Thomas, one of the top analysts in the game, in my opinion, for the UFC and ESPN and his many podcasts and radio show platforms. We're going to go through kind of some of the fallout of some of the big news that's happened as of late, some big changes to UFC 313 with Dan Hooker pulling out of the co-main event against Justin Gaethje on relatively short notice, a big fight for Jose Aldo booked at UFC 315 in Montreal against Ayman Zahabi. Not many of us saw that coming, but the main topic of discussion between Dean and myself is going to revolve around Ilya Topuria vacating the UFC featherweight championship and where that falls into the history of UFC title vacancies. We are going to go over the full list of everyone who has vacated a UFC belt dating all the way back to the first instance in 1999. I think some great discussion leading to some kind of topical points around some topical fighters right now, and of course what this decision means for Ilya Topuria and his move up to lightweight. Will he get Islam Makhachev right away? Will it be something else? We go over all of that. So going to take a quick break here and we'll be right back with Dean Thomas. We're back here on the Bonfire Podcast with the returning guest of the show, Mr. Dean Thomas. I couldn't have enough of our championship draft in December, Dean. I'm kind of tracking the results. It's going interesting so far. I think we've been on point, but had to have you back on, man. How are you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm glad to be back on. I'm curious as to know what the results are from our draft. But I guess maybe we'll give it a little bit more time, right? Is that what we need to do?
We've only had the three title fights. I think we kind of all had them correct, you know, and picking them fairly early on. I think Marab was the one I had some doubts around, but he obviously retained against Umar Nurmagomedov at UFC 311. So maybe at the halfway point of the year, once each champion is maybe being scheduled or something, we can revisit how we're looking.
Okay, good, because I actually had Marab defending this one, but losing later in the year. So I'm curious as to see how this is going to play out.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting. But reason I wanted to have you on today, obviously being a crazy newsworthy couple of weeks here, I think one of the biggest pieces of news we've got so far in 2025 is Ilya Topuria deciding he's going to vacate the featherweight championship and move up to lightweight. That's led to them booking a vacant title fight between Alexander Volkanovski and Diego Lopez for UFC 314. So kind of wanted to talk a little bit about that, but also go over the history of every champion who has vacated their title throughout the course of UFC history, because there's only a handful of them, but I think they all kind of have interesting storylines. And I don't really know if there's one that falls in line with what Ilya decided to do here. So pretty fascinating stuff. But before then, Dean, as we get into the vacant championship list, I want to talk about a little bit of news that's kind of hit us this week as you know, we kind of roll closer to UFC 313. We lose the co-main event. Dan Hooker announces that he has a hand injury again. He's had a number of these in recent years, had to pull out of some fights, and he will not be fighting Justin Gaethje at UFC 313 any longer. I think everyone highlighted this as maybe an early fight of the year candidate. How disappointed are you that we aren't going to see Hooker versus Gaethje?
I mean, it is pretty disappointing, but it leads me to a bigger question. And that is, you know, what are these guys doing in training that they're always getting injured, especially on these big opportunity fights? Just training hard is a requirement, but there has to be some type of limitations. I don't know what these guys are doing in training where they're constantly getting hurt. Like, how are you, like, at this level? And what's at stake for these guys, how much money they make and all that comes with being a championship level fighter, because, you know, this is a championship level fight. You got Justin Gaethje, Dan Hooker, the winner could possibly be in line for a title shot in a division where there are no clear cut number one contenders. This seemed to be like a number one contender type fight. Mm-hmm. How do you get hurt? I don't get it. I mean, I do know how you can get hurt. I mean, I've been around long enough to know that injuries happen and there are accidents happen. But how do you let this happen? How do you let this happen? It's wild to me. But, you know, there are options. So it just sucks that this happened, because this was a fight that everybody was looking forward to. Mm-hmm. But We move forward. We push on, Mike Bond.
Yeah, I mean, can you give any insight on like how an injury like that happens so close to the fight? I mean, like, is it just a weird sparring thing, especially with the hand? Like, you punch the top of your training partner's head in a weird moment, like in the last couple sparrings. Like, how do you break a hand? We don't know if it is a break, but obviously bad enough to pull out of the fight.
You know, I'm going to be hypocritical here because when I was going to fight Eve Edwards back at UFC 42, I think it was, I actually broke my hand on Thiago Alves' face mask. He was wearing one of those face masks, like it was like a headgear that had a plastic face mask on the front. And I had those old school Bruce Lee ninja gloves. But again, this was back in 2004, maybe 2003, 2004. And we didn't know a lot about training. There wasn't a lot at line on the line. And we're just scrapping. And I punch his face mask and I ended up hurting my hand. But we're 2025. These guys are making six figures. Mm-hmm. I was making, you know, four or five, you know what I'm saying? If I was lucky and I had a real job and, you know, we're just scrapping. But when you got so much on the line, like, you have to monitor this. Sometimes I question the idea of these big rooms, because when these guys are training, you get these big rooms and everybody's just training hard and everybody's scrapping and no one's really paying attention to the little things like that, like people running into each other or just negligence in terms of the protection that you need in training. Mm-hmm. You don't really see this happen a lot in boxing, right? And I understand that boxing is different because it's just punching, but still, like, when you go to a boxing gym, you go to like Wild Card in LA, it's two guys sparring and everybody's watching. It's two guys. MMA is so different where it's just these big rooms and everybody's training and everybody's scrapping and there's a lot of negligence going on. And I question whether that's the right format for fighters at this level. I think that we can eliminate a lot of injuries if we just pay attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you'd like to think, you know, someone like Dan Hooker, I think he has almost 40 MMA fights. He's been doing this forever, high level fights. He has to, I'd hope, know what he's doing at this point. Maybe it was just a freak accident. And like we said, this has been a reoccurring thing with him, but so unfortunate, so close to the fight. And we were looking forward to this and a huge opportunity for him, right? Like, he's worked so hard to get back to the spot of a fight like this against someone like Justin Gaethje to pull out on 11 days notice is pretty rough.
Well, that's just it though. Like, when you got a guy with 40 fights, for him, he's thinking, man, just going to get my work. It's the same thing I've done. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. I love the way we train. But is that the right way to do it? I'm not sure it's the right way to do it. I'm more leaning towards, look, man, you're going to make about $500,000 here. You're making, you know, somewhere $500,000 here. Mm-hmm. Let's make sure we protect you in training so that you can get the best work that you can possibly get, but show up in one piece. I mean, it just, when you miss out on paydays and you're injured, you don't go into the fight fully healthy. So I think guys have to do a better job of, and I'm not picking on Dan Hooker, I'm just saying in general, this is just kind of an illustration, an example of something that's so close, but we got to do a better job of making sure our athletes show up to the fight in one piece.
Yeah. And I mean, this is obviously nothing new. This has been the history of the UFC forever. Last minute changes, last minute pullouts, fighters getting injured. It happens all the time. And what they've been very good at is being on the fly and figuring out how to make these situations palatable for the fans with a good replacement. They've done a decent job rebuilding 313. Like, it was looking pretty rough for a few weeks there. Then they added some good fights, Jalen Turner versus Bahamundes and stuff. But like, this was, I think, the one everyone was circling on this card outside of the main events. So I guess in the like waking moments since this happened, so far we've already had three fighters offer to step in. We had Renato Moicano saying he's ready to go on 2 weeks notice. Mateus Gamrot say he's ready to go on 2 weeks notice, both guys who train out of Florida down there. And then Rafael Fiziev as well, who said he would love a rematch with Justin Gaethje and he's been looking hard for a fight. Do you think any of these would be suitable replacements? Is there something else that comes to top of mind that you think would be best to have fight Justin Gaethje on this short of notice, assuming Justin's even down to take a replacement?
No, I think that you definitely have to go at one of those three guys if Justin Gaethje's down and take a replacement. But who does that, you know, except for Diego Lopez? Think about that. Like, if Justin Gaethje's probably at the point now where he's like, man, listen, I like preparing for specific guys, and if that doesn't work out, then I'm going to sit on the shelf, which would be unfortunate for him because he misses out on a payday as well. And you, to put him in a spot like this where he either has to miss out on a payday or take a new guy, it's kind of unfortunate for him. But if he does accept, I say you go with Renato Moicano, the man who took that short notice fight against Islam Makhachev, who's always been ready, who's always there. I like the Fazeev call out, but you know, he's been sitting a while. And if I'm Justin Gaethje, I'm like, man, I've been there, done that. I already beat this dude. So I'm going with Renato Moicano. I think that makes the most sense. Poor Mateusz Gamrot can't catch a break. But at the end of the day, no one really wants to see him fight. And then no one really wants to fight him because it's not going to be that interesting of a fight in terms of what the fans want. So I say in this spot, you go with Renato Moicano. It might end up being just as good of a fight as if you had Dan Hooker.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense too. He's still got the focus and the clout from taking that title fight on short notice. He didn't really take any damage from Islam, so I think it makes a ton of sense for him to go in there. But I think what you said, do you think Justin Gaethje will take a replacement? Because a weird situation for him, right? Like, he takes pretty much the full year off after getting knocked out by Max Holloway at UFC 300. A lot of questions about where he's at, and he has been vocal in the past that, you know, he dedicates this whole training camp to this certain mentality that he brings into these fights that is very unique, you know, willing to put his life on the line in there and for a change up on last minute. Like he said, he doesn't like to take short notice fights, but will he take a short notice replacement? And I think the UFC will most definitely want him to, right? Like, this card, not the thickest, to have Justin Gaethje not be on this event anymore, I think would be pretty damaging to UFC 313.
Yeah. They're probably going to have to break him off a little bit and make it worth his while. But if the UFC is smart, they make it work and put Renato Moicano in this spot. While, like you said, Renato Moicano was fresh on everybody's mind. He took that fight against Islam. That's money Moicano. He's the man right now. And it gives him a chance to redeem himself. Now, can he beat Justin Gaethje? We don't know. But I think it's a little bit more closely contested than the Islam fight. So I would love to see Renato Moicano in this spot. It's a more challenging fight for Justin Gaethje, I actually think, because he's not really worried about Dan Hooker taking him down. And Adam Moicano has a little bit more diverse of a skill set than Dan Hooker. So it'll be questionable whether Justin Gaethje even accepts one of those guys. But if he's going to accept one of them, it's got to be Renato Moicano.
Yeah, well, we'll find out what happens here. I don't want to talk too much about this. And, you know, we got a replacement in a couple hours and dates this whole conversation. So we'll see what they do here. But nevertheless, they only got limited time. So we'll see if Hunter Campbell can work his magic as he has with some of these replacements. But the other bit of fight announcement news we got today, Dean Thomas, was a big addition to UFC 315 in Montreal. May 10th, I believe. That card is filling out nicely, headlined by Bilal Muhammad against Jack Della Maddalena and Valentina Shevchenko versus Manon Fiorot. The UFC Hall of Famer, Dean, Jose Aldo, is fighting Ayman Zahabi on this card. Ayman on a nice winning streak at bantamweight, but if anyone told me they saw this fight coming on their bingo card in 2025, I think they'd be lying.
Oh, I mean, you couldn't have told me this was going to be a thing years ago. I mean, we have kind of written off Ayman Zahabi. Ayman Zahabi for years has just been Faraz's brother.
Yeah.
Oh, Faraz has a brother that fights. Faraz has a brother that fights. And he quietly snuck up on everybody as a contender. Mm-hmm. He quietly did this. Like, he just kind of snuck up and then just was beating guys. And you didn't even realize that he was at that level because he was always Faraz's brother. Mm-hmm. And Faraz is such he's a wizard in the game. But you also kind of know Faraz is like the grappling guy. And Ayman comes out knocking people out.
Yeah.
It's such a weird way to sneak up on the world. But this is and when you look at that and you think, okay, he's knocking people out, it's a perfect fight for a guy like Jose Aldo. You would think that a nice little striking battle is going to ensue here. So this is an interesting matchup. I love it. I think this is a good opportunity for Ayman to really get on everybody's, like you said, bingo card. I think this is a good opportunity to showcase himself for the bantamweight division, because that division is still hot. It's still steaming. And Ayman can insert himself right into the mix of guys that we all love to see fight anyway.
Yeah. Do you feel like this is the best use of Jose Aldo at this point in his career, though? I mean, like, what did Mario Bautista really gain from that fight? If anything, it hurt him. Do you think, like, you know, this is something, I know for Ayman, if he wins, it's great. But like, if we have finite amount of Jose Aldo fights left, is this what they should be doing as opposed to like a Henry Cejudo or Dominic Cruz before he retired, fights more on the level?
Yeah, but, you know, those are gambles. You know, I think you kind of have to use Jose where you can, because we don't know what he's going to do. We don't know how much he has left. So I think you kind of have to – you don't want to really gamble and say, okay, let's get him more Henry Cejudo or Dominic Cruz, because we don't even know what they got left. So I guess they're trying to build Ayman. If Ayman can get there, he's got to get past a guy like Jose Aldo. And if Jose Aldo wants to stick around, he's got to beat Ayman. So I think this is not a bad spot for him. Plus, it just makes this card in Montreal that much deeper. Because when you think about going to Montreal, you got to have a stacked card. You got to you can't go all the way in the middle of Canada and not have a stacked card. You got to use Jose somewhere.
No, it's very true. I mean, the GSP days when he was headlining in Montreal were glamorous and absolutely insane. But like, I think the last time they went to Montreal about 10 years ago, it was headlined by, I think, Demetrius Johnson versus Kyoji Horiguchi, and half the arena was empty. Ooh. And it was like, it was startling. Ooh. A little bit.
Yeah, talk about a bummer. But and listen, and the last time we saw Jose Aldo in Toronto, he put on a great fight against Mark Hominick. He swelled my man's forehead up. So yeah, this definitely seems like a good spot for him. And fighting a Canadian. So like, I think this is a great opportunity.
Yeah, just definitely a little surprising, but nevertheless, this is the UFC matchmaking. Sometimes credit to them for getting Jose Aldo to even take a fight like this, because I think some others in his position probably would not be as willing. But nevertheless, Aldo is our former featherweight champion. That ducktails perfectly into the conversation around Ilia Topuria and vacating his featherweight title. And as I said off the top here, Dean, I'd like to go back throughout the history, and I pulled up all the instances of champions vacating belts throughout the course of UFC history, and I'm going to start reading them off here. We can stop as we go and kind of give a little commentary on some of the more notable ones. Obviously, I wanted to have you on for this combo because you go way back in the sport. You were probably around for all these instances as they happen. Some of them, especially the first few, were a little before my time covering the sport. So any insight you can provide on these two early ones in particular, I'd be intrigued. So the first ever UFC title vacancy. And I guess before I get into this, there is a distinguishment between being stripped and vacating a belt, right? Like stripped.
Yeah.
UFC takes
we
it away
took from, it you. From you. Yeah.
Yeah. Not under your own decision. These vacancies are fighters that largely in part, it was their own decision for one reason or another. So first one that we have here on the list was Bas Rutten. Vacated the title in June of 1999, the heavyweight belt, in order to drop to light heavyweight. And then he retired soon after due to injuries. I don't even know if he made that light heavyweight run. So that was the first instance. Do you recall Bas Rutten deciding to give up his belt and being the first fighter to do so?
Yes, I do. I mean, it doesn't stand out in my mind because nothing like from that period really does, because people don't understand it. The UFC then is not what it is now. Not even in terms of just the sport itself. I'm not talking about the sport of MMA itself. I'm talking about the UFC as an organization. Mm-hmm. So anything prior to say 2003 for the UFC was just like, the UFC was not the biggest, or was not looked at as the biggest organization in the world. So for Bas Rutten to give up the title then was just like, hey, I'm just going to give up this title and do something different, because it wasn't that prestigious as it is today. And I say that because I know from experience, because they offered me a fight against Jens Pulver for the very first UFC lightweight championship back in 2000. And I turned it down because I was like, man, UFC, WEF, all these other Shooto, all these other organizations were just as big as the UFC. So it wasn't that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. Earlier in the UFC days, it wasn't that big of a deal. So for Bas Rutten to give it up, he was just probably like, you know what? I'm just going to move down away. No big deal.
Did you regret turning that fight down at all? Or do you think it was the right decision for you at the time, even in hindsight?
No, it was a terrible decision in hindsight.
looking
back now, I'm thinking, why in the hell did I do that? Like, what was I thinking in hindsight? Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, hindsight's 2020 sometimes. Okay, the second one came just a few months later, when in November 1999, Frank Shamrock vacated his title, citing a lack of competition and wanting to compete elsewhere. Your thoughts?
That cannot be the reason. I hear this and I'm thinking that cannot be the reason. There's no way that's the reason.
We'd have to talk to Frank himself, but I think he had defended that title, I think, five times and was looking for some challenges elsewhere from the UFC or outside the organization.
Well, again, that's where, when I talk about the prestige of being a UFC champion, just wasn't as great as it is today. It didn't mean the same thing. Mm-hmm. So, but to say a lack of competition, that can't be the reason. I can see him just thinking that the UFC is not, it wasn't worth holding, but to say that there's a lack of cost, that can't be the reason. legend. But if that's what he says, that's I got to take Frank's word.
So well, I'd love to circle back with Frank one day. He's kind of disappeared off the radar, but hopefully he pops up for a UFC Hall of Fame induction at some point. I don't know if Dana will ever smooth things over with him to the point of that happening, but I think he has deserved to be in there. We get a massive jump, Dean, from 1999 all the way to December of 2013. So no title vacancies in that huge 14-year gap there. As you said, the UFC really became the prominent organization, and we started adding weight classes and having, you know, standing champions, things like that. It was December 13th, 2013, George St. Pierre vacates the welterweight championship after that fight with Johnny Hendricks. He cited all sorts of things. He wasn't happy with the level of drug testing in the UFC and the whole saga that led into that fight. He was burnt out. He was tired. He had felt the pressure of being champion for so long. That was obviously like a monumental moment when he got on the mic after that fight with Joe Rogan and was like, I don't know what I'm doing, where I'm at. He came back, kind of expressed his thing. And then Dana came in and was not too pleased with him, not with the judges that night. And not with George kind of making that decision on the spot. I don't think he gave them much of a heads up either.
Yeah, this I was talking to a buddy of mine yesterday about being a UFC champion because, you know, right now I'm coaching two fighters that can realistically see a path to a championship. And it's such a good thing to be a champion, to say that you're the best in the world. But the pressure that comes with being a UFC champion is so heavy. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a lot of people get it because I've been around UFC champions, and when they lose the belt, it almost feels a bit relieved for them.
Yeah.
And for George St. Pierre, he admits to hating fighting. He doesn't like fighting. He doesn't like the pressure. He doesn't like all the eyeballs on him. So for him to give up that belt seemed like it was inevitable for him. There's no way this guy liked being champion. Mm-hmm. He liked being the best in the world, and he loves martial arts. He loves competing. He loves training, but being a champion was just too heavy for him. So for him to give it up, especially after that decision against Johnny Hendricks, where it was such a closely contested fight, many people might not even have thought he won. So for him to give that up, I'm sure the moment he gave that up and he went back to his hotel room or went back home, I'm sure he had a sigh of relief that he was just like, thank God I can just relax and breathe.
And you mentioned the stuff earlier as we talked about Ayman Zahabi in Canada. I mean, like that time from 2008 to 2013, George couldn't walk down the street anywhere in Canada. He was beyond famous. He was a role model for not just Canadian sports, but like sports as a whole. He was such a great person for the UFC in that stage because he handled himself so professionally. He came to the press conferences in the suits, like all this stuff that kind of made it seem like a very legitimate modern athlete. But yeah, just the weight of that was a ton, and he had some tough fights. And that Johnny Hendricks one in particular was, you know, I thought that night that he had lost that fight when they were reading the decision. It went his way. But yeah, I could understand him walking away at that point, but it was just on such a high. And I know Dana White and the UFC probably saw money signs in a Johnny Hendricks rematch after that fight. So I'm sure they weren't thrilled to get that. But this did lead to the Robbie Lawler title run, which was one of the most amazing times in our sport too.
Yeah, what a good run. And it made sense. It's almost like when guys are no longer champion, it gives somebody else an opportunity. It just reinvigorates the entire division and our love watching it. Mm-hmm. So you could see George St. Pierre just not being all that happy, and he's kind of miserable as champion. We don't realize it until he gives it up. And then we see another guy get in that spot. Mm-hmm. And then we see this new life in that title. And we go, man, wow, this is cool. So to watch, especially watching a guy like Robbie Lawler have his time, because we watched him grow up in the UFC and actually get kicked out of the UFC and come back and then win a title. I mean, that was a good time for us.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, we'll circle back to George again because he finds himself on this list twice. But in between there, January 2014, Dominic Cruz vacates the bantamweight championship after numerous injuries. He had held the belt for a while. They put an interim title in there where Henan Barao won and actually defended it. So setting the groundwork for Tom Aspinall way back in 2014 as defending an interim title. And then, I think the time came where he was scheduled to fight Dominic, and Dominic suffered another injury in a unifier, and they just had to he decided to vacate and they could move on with Barao as the full champion. But man, on the I guess this is timely too with Dominic Cruz recently retiring due to another injury. This is just the story of his career, right? Like having to give up a damn belt because of injuries.
Yeah, that's the story of his career for sure. Not so, and that foreshadowed his ending in a sense, like him having to give up the belt because of injuries, then him having to retire because of injuries. So poor Dominic Cruz, like injuries just killed him in terms of his career and maybe what his potential was, or maybe that's what his potential was. Maybe we saw his potential and the injuries just saved us of having to watch him go out there and get beat up by guys. Right. Yeah. So maybe that's really, maybe it did him a favor to having to give up that belt and heal himself. And it may have lengthened his career a bit, you know, him taking as much time off of as he did. So I think him giving up the belt was actually a blessing in disguise.
Yeah. I would have loved to see that fight at the time, though, peak Barão, and he was on that like 32 fight undefeated streak against Cruz in that moment. That would have been pretty fascinating. But I think definitely Cruz's career will hold up longer in the history books than Henan Barão. That was more of a flash in the pan, it feels like, in hindsight.
Well, that's the thing with Cruz is that two things will remember him by is the injuries and then all the fights that didn't happen that we wanted to see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
Jose Aldo, Henan Barão. Like, there's a lot of fights that we wish we had seen with Cruz that never really materialized. But Hall of Fame for sure, though.
Yeah, I wonder how soon they'll induct him. Okay, so we once again hit George St. Pierre on this list, December 2017, just, I think, 33 days after he beat Michael Bisping to become middleweight champion in his return from a 4.5-year hiatus after vacating that welterweight title and retiring. He comes back, beats Michael Bisping, and then gives it up 33 days later. I think it was in the books one of the shortest title reigns in UFC history. I think Jermaine Durandamy might have been stripped a little faster than he was when she refused to fight Cyborg. But yeah, I mean, that was a weird one. I know the UFC, and he had told them he would unify titles with Robert Whittaker, who was the interim champion at the time after beating Yoel Romero. But he had this stomach issue that I guess was really plaguing him throughout camp and afterwards. And I guess George couldn't fight anymore. So he called that, and that was his last fight.
Well, I don't want to make light of his stomach issues. Matt Serra has the same thing, ulcerative colitis.
Yes.
And I don't want to make light of that, but let's call this what it was. This was a complete bank robbery on George St. Pierre's part. He swept in and took that title from Michael Bisping because that was essentially the best matchup for him in the middleweight division. And it was it wasn't an easy time for him, but it was the perfect matchup for him. Because
it was John Jones versus Stipe Miocic.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, yeah, exactly, 100%. It was John Jones versus Stipe Miocic. If Yoel Romero had the title then, if Robert Whittaker had the title then, George St. Pierre does not come back and fight for that belt. It was because it was Michael Bisping. He said, you know what? I'm going to tell them whatever they need me to say. I'm going to go in and get this belt. I'm going to become a two-division champion, which is a very rare occasion in MMA. He did that. Perfect timing for him. He got his money. He got his belt, and he ran with it. And he said, yo, I'm out before I have to defend this thing. And you can blame it on the stomach issues or not, but let's just call it what it was. It was a bank robbery, and props to George for doing that.
Yeah, fair play.
You know, he deserves it. He deserved it.
Of course, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, like you said, not trying to make light. What he did say is like he couldn't even keep his weight up to 185 throughout training camp and especially afterwards. So it would have been interesting to see him fight a Yoel Romero or something like that. He's not small for 185, but yeah, we didn't get that period, and definitely a decision that I think helped preserve the legacy of George St. Pierre. Would have loved to see him come back again and fight Khabib, but that's a whole other topic we never got to there. But he did that night, for whatever it was worth, the bank robbery. I still think that might be the greatest event in UFC history, UFC 217. He beats Bisping in the co-main event. TJ Dillashaw beats Cody Garbrandt. And then Rose Namajunas upsets Joanna Jędrzejczyk. That was a real special night.
I remember that. And the most impressive thing that happened that weekend in New York was I did comedy at this comedy club.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah. wearing a Trump onesie.
Oh, Lord. Yeah. But that event, UFC 217, still the only event in UFC history with three title changes on one night. So
I remember that.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty special. Okay, we fast forward now, Dean, pretty much a year to December 2018. Daniel Cormier vacates the light heavyweight title after winning the heavyweight championship, knocking out Stipe Miocic. And I think at this point, they were looking at doing the second fight with Stipe and filming the Ultimate Fighter and everything. And it just seemed like DC physically was done cutting down to 205. You could see it on the frame and everything. He talks about it all the time. Once he knew that he had that second belt at heavyweight, he knew knew his business at 205 was done and that he was ready to get on from that point. And I think they booked John Jones against, who was it, Obin St. Preux for a vacant belt or something like that? I can't remember.
Yeah, well, you know, that's... DC was, I thought he was in throughout his career, I thought he was always a better heavyweight than a light heavyweight. Just stylistically, the way he fought and he used his smaller size to his advantage to be able to get in on these heavyweights, to out pummel them on the inside, get them to the ground, and just, and heavyweights just don't grapple very well. So DC was a much better heavyweight than a light heavyweight. So I thought it was the best move for DC. That was a very intelligent business decision for DC. DC always makes good business decisions. He's not a dummy in the game. He makes the best business decisions, and that was one of them.
Yeah, and just to correct myself there, he vacated the belt, and then John Jones rematched Alexander Gustafsson for the vacant title at that point. In that event, they moved on 3 or 4 days' notice from Las Vegas to California. That was a crazy time as well.
Yeah.
DC, of course, you know, was, I think, one of two guys or one of two people who defended both belts in both divisions. So once he kind of went back after the first fight and, you know, did all the stuff that he needed to do, beat Ozdemir and all those things, like you said, right business decision for him to move on. And this is an interesting one now, Dean. March of 2019, TJ Dillashaw vacates the bantamweight title after he fails a drug test for EPO. This is a weird one. I mean, he got out of ahead of it, announced the news before USADA put out the press release and said, you know, I'm vacating the belt, I made this mistake. You could put this one in the category of being stripped because, like, come on, the belt was going away no matter what after the situation. But TJ did get out ahead of it. One of the more honest fighters, I can say, who spoke openly about his use of performance-enhancing drugs. So he gets some credit for that whole saga.
Wait a minute. I'm not giving him no credit for that. Come on. No! Do you give him credit for that? Like, he was going to get caught anyway. That's like coming in and quitting before you get fired. Like, hey, that's like, hey man, when you show up to work today, they're going to fire you. Oh, where are they going to fire me? Watch this. I'm going to quit before I get fired. That's what he did. He quit before he got fired.
I don't give him credit for vacating the title. I give him credit for how openly he spoke. Well, if you don't believe it, that's fair. But like he said, I intentionally did this. I couldn't make the weight. I needed something to help me, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I mean, again, when you get caught, it's easy to be honest about, all right.
But, you know, he could say contaminated supplements. Someone gave me this. Someone gave me that. You've heard every excuse in the book we've possibly had. He could have picked any of those.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm still not going to give him any credit the way you are. I don't give him credit for that. And the reason why I don't give him credit for that is just how hard he is on other guys, particularly Anthony Smith. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's hard on these guys. And like, but the fact that you cheated and then you admitted to it. So yeah, props to you for admitting to it, but you still cheated. Yeah. So.
Nope. Fair play. Okay. We move on to a back-to-back one here, late 2019, early 2020. 2020 was a very interesting year for this, as we'll get into it, but Henry Cejudo vacates the flyweight title and then just a few months later vacates the bantamweight title. This is timely, obviously. We've just seen Henry lose this past weekend to Song Yadong. 0-3 since coming out of retirement. As of May, it'll be 5 years since he last won a fight. We could bunch these together, him vacating the flyweight title and the bantamweight title. Worst decision of anyone on this list? I don't know.
Mike, no one. Hindsight's 20/20. But no one has gambled worse with their career than Henry Cejudo. For as great of a fighter he is, I mean, we probably the greatest combat sports athlete ever, considering what he's done. UFC champion in two different divisions, Olympic gold medal. Like, no, like, to do one of those things is difficult. And this guy did three of them. But to overestimate his value to the company was just a terrible business decision. Terrible. Like, he thought he was more important than he was. And it's, I always tell fighters or anybody in life, I tell people this, like, it's, you should value yourself with in high esteem. Like, you should always, but don't expect other people to. You can't tell other people how to value you. That's not your place. If somebody says you're not worth it, unfortunately, if that's the perception that you're not worth it, you're not worth it. He found out the hard way, and it really ruined. I don't want to say ruin. It didn't ruin his legacy, but it definitely puts his legacy in a different light than it would be had he stuck around and maybe made some different decisions. But I feel bad for him kind of. And that sucks to say because he still is very successful. Mm-hmm. But, man, for someone who's the greatest combat sports athlete that we've ever seen to achieve what he's done, to have missed out on so much because he overvalued himself, it sucks.
I do think he definitely overvalued himself. That was for sure. But I do think some of his retirement came related to burnout and the weight cuts a little bit. I mean, this guy has been doing this since he was, 4 years old, like being in the combat sports wrestling world. So I think there was a little element of that, but definitely I think it was a bargaining chip. I don't know what he thought, like UFC was going to come back and offer him a 45 fight with Volkanovski or like something. But dude, when you have those belts, when you have the pay-per-view points, like giving that up voluntarily is a hell of a move because it takes so long and such select fighters get into that position to give it up when you have it is crazy.
That's why you have to strike while the iron is hot. Mm-hmm. And you got to take advantage of it when the iron is hot, because once it's not, it doesn't generally get hot again. You know, Robbie Lawler, we talked about Robbie Lawler. Robbie Lawler seen that resurgence, and some fighters have seen a resurgence. Charles Oliveira has seen a resurgence. But they didn't get all the way to the top and then fall off and then come back. Like, they got to the middle of the pack, fell off, and then was really able to come back and get to the top. Mm-hmm. You rarely ever see a guy get all the way to the top, then fall off, and then get all the way to the top again. It just doesn't happen. Once you get to the top, that's kind of it, man. That's And we're seeing it now with a lot of different guys, for whether it's Henry Cejudo, Izzy, like these guys, they get all the way to the top. Then once you start losing, it just doesn't come back.
Yeah. Do you think Henry retires again now, or gonna try to get a couple more fights in? Does he need his retirement?
Well, I think his ego won't allow him to retire. And to be fair, he looked pretty good in this fight. He didn't look bad. It's just, but who's he come back and fight? Like, he's got to come back and fight another top guy. These guys don't get an opportunity to rebuild themselves. Yeah. So, like, who's he come back and fight? And
I'd mentioned Aldo, who's now booked, as we talked about, or Chito. He was supposed to fight Chito Vera in Boston a couple years ago. That didn't happen.
Well, if I'm him, I'm trying to get either Chito or Rob Font.
Yeah.
You know, find a guy who can't really wrestle all that great. You know, like this, that's the only thing that I'm doing.
If you find a guy who can't really wrestle, you actually have to wrestle him, Henry.
Yeah. And then you got to go out there and wrestle him. But I mean, you know, he struggled with the footwork of Song, couldn't get in deep enough to get a good clean shot. So he kind of had to play on the outside a little longer than I think he wanted to. But, you know, if he gets a guy like Rob Font or Chito, guys that don't really move as fast as Song and don't wrestle as well, I think he can have some success there.
Yeah. Okay, we move on to the mid of 2020. We had how many? 4 vacancies in 2020, which is kind of crazy. The next one, which you said, rolling the dice, John Jones vacates the light heavyweight title in August 2020. He wasn't pleased with his salary negotiations with the UFC. He wanted to move to heavyweight. Dana White said he wanted the Deontay Wilder money. I think it was $30 million. He wanted, you know, his big payday to go to heavyweight. And it took almost 4 years after that to get John Jones to debut at the heavyweight division with the contract he was happy on. We didn't get the Francis Ngannou fight in there, whoever you can blame for that, but he was trying to get a better deal to fight at heavyweight, and he gave up his light heavyweight belt before he had that deal in place, and it led to multiple years away from the sport for John Jones. That was an interesting saga as well.
John Jones has ruined every physical and universal law there is towards MMA. Yeah. You know, all these things that I talk about like not liking to be champion, the pressure, giving it up, and, you know, not being able to come back. Like, John Jones just kind of debunks all the myths of that because, I mean, I don't know how he's done it. Honestly, I don't know how he's been able to stick around at the top, fail drug tests, come back, still beat the next best guy, give up the belt, come back, beat the best guy, come back. I don't know how he does it, man. You know, John Jones is just, you just say, all right, he's outside of the box. He really is. He really is outside of the box. He's not like a human, like any other human fighter there is. He just, John Jones has been able to do what he does, and I can't explain it. No. I can't. He's just different.
Yeah, we could talk about this man forever. I mean, he vacated the title here, but I think he was stripped twice before that for various reasons.
Yeah, stripped. I mean, And then he comes back and then just beats the next best guy.
Yep.
I don't get it.
Yep. But this was a very interesting choice. I mean, the fight, if he had stayed at 205 and kept that belt, would have been the Dominic Reyes rematch, which I think would have been very high selling at that point, given the first fight. But he wanted to move on and go to heavyweight, but we didn't get that Ngannou fight. And it was a long time waiting there. You just wonder about the lost opportunity, the lost earnings, all that stuff. I mean, the last thing I'll say about John Jones is all the stuff you just listed there, all the time off, he's still the GOAT of the sport. Could you imagine what his resume looked like if he didn't take 2 or 3 year breaks multiple times along the way? I mean, you can only fathom.
I don't know, man. I mean, again, I'm going to refer back to my Dominic Cruz theory, and that could possibly be maybe taking those breaks gave him a little bit more length in his career, taking less damage. But then the flip side to that is the game changes so fast. To be able to take those breaks and still stay ahead of the game and still stay current with what's going on in the game, because it changes. Like from my perspective and working with fighters, you got to stay in the game because it changes. So for him to take those breaks and not lose a step and still be ahead of the curve is remarkable. Like, I don't understand how he's doing it. I don't know. Like, he should be studied. You know, when he's gone, we're going to take his brain and study it to figure out what the hell he did, because it's different.
Yeah, for multiple reasons on that one. Okay, the last one of 2020 that we got, October 24th, 2020, Khabib Nurmagomedov announces his retirement in the cage. The belt should have become vacant then, the lightweight title, but the UFC doesn't officially acknowledge that until March of 2021. I still hold the opinion to this day that after Khabib said he was done, explained his reasoning very clearly, Dustin Poirier versus Conor McGregor, UFC 257 should have been for the vacant title. Dustin Poirier should have got his undisputed lightweight belt when he knocked out Conor in Abu Dhabi, but the UFC refused to acknowledge this retirement from Khabib. Dana White doing his very best to try to get him to come back for one more, offering all the money. I think Khabib has said $30 million or something for a Conor rematch. He said no, but the fact the division couldn't really move on was a weird one here. There should have been a new champion, but they didn't acknowledge Khabib's retirement till March. But that was the lightweight title being vacated there. I think we know the story very well of why Khabib did this.
Yeah, Khabib is a man of integrity, and he's a man of his word, and we have to honor that. I do wish that the UFC did honor that and then crowned Dustin Poirier the champion. But it's unfortunate that the UFC didn't honor his retirement, and this is something that I think we all have a problem with. Except for me, of course, because
well, the fighters give us good reason and fairness. I mean,
yeah, well, I just, when fighters want to retire, I'm all for that always. I'm like, yo, this is such a crap. Like, for the same reason why, like, I would never let my son be a fighter. Like, yo, dude, just get out of this. Like, get in, get as much money as you can, and get out. And if you never have to get in, don't get in. But, you know, when fighters want to get out, when they're just done with it, it's too dangerous of a sport to stick around. And when Khabib retired, when he said he was done, we should have accepted that. We should have just said, all right, man, you know what? You've given us great moments, you've given us some memories to talk about, and you've created this this whole mystique, and you've created this whole genre of fighters after you, the Dagestani thing. Like, that was a thing that Khabib single-handedly created, and that shadow still cast upon MMA today, and we should have just accepted that. But because we didn't, you know, Dustin Poirier never got his true due of being the undisputed UFC champion of the world.
Yeah, and they still won't fully let it go. I mean, Khabib told me that they reached out to his team for UFC 300. So there's still someone in the UFC office still thinks this man can fight again. But nevertheless, we move on. I want to kind of zip through these last few so we can talk about Ilia Topuria. So I'll batch these last two groups together. November 2023, Jiří Procházka vacates the belt after light heavyweight belt after a serious shoulder injury. Jamal Hill wins the vacant belt some months after that, has to vacate it after tearing his Achilles, partially playing a UFC pickup basketball game in Las Vegas. Two unfortunate things, but, you know, both those guys have come back healthy, had their chance to reclaim the belt, both lost to Alex Pereira. So it's what it is on that front. And then the last I have on my list before Ilia Topuria is June 10th, 2023, when the legend Amanda Nunes announces her retirement in the cage, vacates both the women's bantamweight and the women's featherweight, if you want to call the latter a true divisional title, both those titles, laying him down, moves on. And we are still experiencing the post Amanda Nunes era a little bit here in the women's side of the sport. So that brings it all up. Do you, any thoughts on either of those ones or just?
Yeah. So I'll speak on the Amanda one first, because I was very close to her during her reign. I helped her get prepared. I helped her win the belt from Miesha Tate and helped her train for Ronda, and I trained her for Valentina. So, and she is very much like GSP. She didn't like it. She didn't like being champ. She liked being the best in the world and she liked fighting, but she just didn't like being champion. Like, she's not a person to be in the spotlight. So, for her to give it up was the right thing for her, because like, she didn't want it. But for Jamahal Hill and Jiří Procházka, I thought that what they did was extremely honorable. Especially when Jiří gave it up, he was like, yo, I'm out, so let these other guys handle it. And then Jamahal Hill was like, I'm not going to be outdone by this guy. I'll give it up too. So I thought what they did was extremely honorable. I don't know how they feel about it in hindsight. You know, in hindsight, they might be look back and be like, damn, why'd I do that? But because they never got it back, right? So but to me, I thought it was still the right thing to do, and it was honorable. So I commend them for being honest and noble for giving up the belt, knowing that they couldn't defend it.
Agreed. So now that we've gone through this list and we get into Ilia Topuria, who we spoke about, vacated the featherweight belt. I feel like the closest comparison, I guess, would be the John Jones vacating the light heavyweight title to go up to heavyweight. I think we could all say it's probably not going to be 4 years until Ilia makes his lightweight debut, but pretty fascinating. I mean, what did you think of this whole thing? I know some of it's probably a product of schedule. UFC wants a featherweight title fight in Miami at UFC 314, but and Ilya's been talking about going up to lightweight forever, but are you surprised that he was willing to make this decision now?
Yeah, it's wild to me that he's giving this up now. It's like, there's no way a guy gives up pay-per-view points and his status as UFC champion this soon for no apparent reason. It seems like no real reason other than,
well,
like,
Dana he just says doesn't he can't make the weight. Do you buy that?
I don't necessarily buy that. Like, he's a young guy. It may be uncomfortable for him to make the weight, but I don't necessarily believe that he can't make the weight. But if he wants to go up, I think, all right, let's let him go up. But it comes from a place of just almost like you said, that John Jones level of confidence and maybe a bit of delusion that you kind of have to be a good fighter. But to think that you are just going to give up the belt, no problem. I'll just get it at lightweight. It's such a wild way of thinking.
Islam Makhachev is the champion.
Yeah, it's such a delusional way. It's this crazy delusional way of thinking. But in order to be that good, you have to be that delusional. Like, John Jones is that delusional. Like, he just doesn't believe he can be beat. And you have to think that way. Most guys, there are a lot of guys that think that way, though, but they're not that good. So, like, for them to think that way and also be that good is crazy. But Ilia Topuria is that good, and he thinks that way. It's just, we're living in wild times. We may be looking at somebody special. I don't want to say he's not just yet, but if he is that dude, man, I'm just glad to be a part of it. But I still like have my reservations on that thought, though, because not many people are that good and are that delusional at the same time.
Yeah. What more does he need to prove to put on the level? I guess he said he would knock out Volk, knocked him out, said he would knock out Max, knocked him out. What more do you want to see out of him?
I mean, yeah, he did do those things, man. He's streaking. He's got a lot of momentum on his side, and you can't take those away from him. But then also, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, like, we have the one guy he fought at lightweight, Jai Herbert. Like, he got dropped and then came back, and Jai Herbert's really good, actually. He's good, but came back and knocked him out. You know, you still want to see more work from him. Yeah. You want to see some work from him at lightweight at the highest level. You know, you want to see him fight some dogs at lightweight. Like, I would want to see him beat up a guy like Mateos. Can he beat a guy like Mateos Gamrot, who's going to just put pressure on him, wrestling pressure on it? Like, we haven't even seen nobody do that to him at featherweight. So, like, how do we suggest that he can beat a guy like Islam when we haven't seen him beat a guy like Mateos Gamrot or even Hanato Moicano? So, like, it's just tough to say.
Yeah. What do you think they do? Do you think they put Ilya versus Islam together right now. I know from Islam's side, there's been a little like, you know, we'd like to see this guy do something at lightweight first, but I know Islam and his team, I think if the UFC wants that fight, they send him the contract, he will sign it and that'll be the fight. But do you think that is the right fight to make now? Knowing Ilya hasn't fought in this division against one of these top guys, you can build them up. These are two big stars who maybe could be more useful to the UFC as separate entities, as opposed to having one of them lose to each other. What's kind of the game plan if they put the book in your hand? I think
if you're going to do it, you might as well do it now.
Yeah.
Because there is no clear-cut guy at 155. Who's the clear-cut guy at 155?
There's Armin and Charles, but do you just put them against each other in a rematch outside of that? Or?
Well, I think they're mad at Armin for the way he handled that situation. So, like, you don't really do that. I think you could do Ilya and Islam right now, and if Ilya loses, he might go, man, send me back down to 145, you know? And then I think you could do it right now. If they don't do it, you know, why not put Ilya with Dustin Poirier? You know, like, I think that fight kind of makes sense too. Like a boxer versus boxer, you know, Dustin, I'm sure Dustin would probably relish that. I mean,
he's made it clear he would want that one. It's tough. Cause like, I think for Ilya, that's the best way to introduce him to the division. Great style matchup. Everyone loves Dustin. If he beats him and ruins his retirement moment, he kind of gets to embrace that villain side that he leans into a little bit. But Dustin, that feels like a very tough fight to go out.
One thing I know about the UFC is they don't give a damn about your retirement fight. In fact, they would like to see you on your retirement fight be took out on a stretcher in a neck brace.
Well, that's the game. That's pro wrestling.
That's the game. You know, that's the game.
You put over the younger talent.
Yeah, that's the game. Like if you can have a retirement fight that they know about and you come out on top, you've won.
Yeah.
You beat the UFC. Nate Diaz beat the UFC.
Yeah.
No, but it doesn't happen.
And it wouldn't be unusual. I mean, I think I remember a streak in like 2016 or 2017 when we'd go to all the different countries and cities around the world, and there was like a hometown or home country headliner in like 7 or 8 straight international events, and they all lost.
I say that all the time. Yeah. Don't fight in your hometown with the UFC. The UFC, they're going to get you beat up in your hometown. That's their thing, man. They love to see you take a chance against a killer in your hometown. They're going to get you beat up in your hometown.
Yeah. Well, last thing, I guess if they do Ilya versus Islam, is that, you know, an International Fight Week headliner? Is that the biggest fight they could make outside of Jones versus Aspinall? Maybe even bigger. How big of a fight is Ilya versus Islam in your estimation?
I think it's a pretty big fight, man. I think, you know, we talk about, like, I think one of the themes in this show today was like decision making. You know, some guys make really good business decisions, some guys don't. I think this is a risky business decision for Ilya, but if it works out for him, what a great business decision this was.
I mean, dude, if he beats Volkanovski, Max Holloway, and Islam Makhachev in 3 straight fights, I think I saw someone tweet being like, that would be the greatest 3-fight winning streak in MMA history. I don't know if I can think
without a doubt. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, one that comes closer to my mind would be John Jones beating Shogun, defending against Machida, and then defending against Rampage. Like, those guys were all pretty high up there, and he finished them all, like, pretty devastatingly. But I think this would be probably top that.
Oh, I think so, too. I mean, we're talking about two of the greatest featherweights, the two greatest featherweights of all time. That's, you know, I can't think of another one.
Mm-hmm. Jose Aldo.
Jose Aldo, maybe, but both of them beat Jose, so like, so the two greatest featherweights of all time, and then we're talking about on paper, Islam being the greatest lightweight of all time, probably. You know, like, I think his accomplishments, popularity wise, no, like, well, everyone's going to say Habib, but when you talk about like pure accomplishments, then who's done more than Islam? Like, I mean, in terms of like what he's done and like his skill set and all that stuff. If Ilya beats him, man, what a decision that was, and what a gamble that was, and what a way to win in life. Like, if I'm him, I'm beating him, then I'm playing the lottery, and then I'm just chilling. I'm not doing nothing else in life.
Yeah. Agreed, man. It could be something special, an interesting storyline for sure, no doubt, coming into 2025. And I guess what happens with our championship draft there now that Ilya gave up the belt voluntarily? I mean, at the end of the day, he won't be champion at featherweight anymore, so we'll have to figure out how that goes.
Hey, listen, if he loses to Islam, he might go, yo, I'm going back down to 145.
He could still be the champ at the end still of the year. You never know. Okay, dude, I hope things are going good with you. Otherwise, I think you're in Vegas right now, right? And you're
No. I'm in Florida right now. Okay,
but I'll see you out there for UFC 313 next week, right?
Yeah, I'll be out there this weekend and next weekend. So yeah, my man, let's catch up.
There you go. Okay, thank you so much for being back here on the Bonfire, Dean. I'm going to take a quick break to wrap things up, and appreciate your time, man.
No doubt, man. Peace out.
And that does it for another episode of the Bonfire Podcast. Thanks so much to Dean for his time once again. I thought that was a fascinating discussion there. Really some interesting bits as you kind of look in hindsight about why these champions have vacated through the course of history. And Ilya Topuria definitely feels like a unique instance. We haven't really seen this before. As I said, the John Jones one feels like maybe the closest connection, but two completely different circumstances as well there. So it's going to be a massive storyline to follow going forward to see what Ilya Topuria does. We will be discussing anything that happens all along the way here on the Bonfire. I really thought that was a lot of fun digging into it, and I'm absolutely fascinated to see what happens. So appreciate everyone for listening. Appreciate Dean's time. Please make sure to show your support, as I said off the top of the show, any way you can. We put some big benchmarks and thresholds for the show, and hopefully we can keep on pushing here. So hope everyone has a great week, enjoys UFC Vegas 103 this weekend, and we will be back here on UFC 313 pay-per-view fight week next week, right here by the Bonfire.